The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect, the place where we, as blind and partially sighted people, come together to share our views on the big issues affecting us wherever we are in the world. Coming up, we discuss the big issue of the week. It's not just presidential candidates who can be guilty of unwanted touch. Oh no, we hear your stories of the space invaders and how to handle them.
Oh my God, can you just let go of me, please?
Okay. Am I only helping you?
No, you're not.
No,
Wow.
Also, on the other side of the pond, we hear from Ron Graham, once an expert in security within the Texas prison system. Reckless driving led him to a change of direction in his life.
They told me that I was blind, and I said, no, my eyes haven't woken up yet. I was in a coma for 2 months.
Our Society of the Week comes from Hull and East Riding, where Anne Kohler's thirst for company with like-minded people has been more than satisfied by her nominated group.
To blind and partially sighted people, Herib, to me, is the oasis in the desert.
And confronted by their newborn daughter's sight issues, we hear from Olivia's dad how their family coped with the unexpected and have learned not to look too far ahead.
It was only after the midwife left the room that Olivia kind of opened her eyes a little and I noticed that they were opaque.
That's all coming up.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
So welcome to another week on The Weekly Connect. Thank you, as always, for listening. I am Stephen Scott, and I'm here with you this hour. Before we get to our top story this week, I want to just go back to last week's show, which was all about shared space, and we heard about Northumberland County Council's decision to overturn their Morpeth scheme. You might remember that on the programme last week. Thanks to those of you who got in touch in response to that. We got a Facebook post from Steve Merlin Robinson, who says, I use a shared space walking to work in Leeds. Folk on bikes really don't care. They think their little bell gives them the right of way. My guide dog and I get really fed up as it's not clear when it starts and ends. Too many people ride bikes on paths anyway. They are a menace to blind people as well as everyone else. Well, of course, we want to hear your views on all of this. Thanks to Steve for dropping us that message on Facebook. We'll be talking soon to Sarah Gayton, a campaigner on shared space, about the ongoing public inquiries and her involvement in a film Sea of Change in the next couple of weeks. So listen out for that interview. In the meantime, of course, you can always get in touch by emailing us theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. That is theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. So I was talking to a sighted colleague recently, and they were shocked, it's fair to say, by how common it seems that blind people have to put up with being touched in public. And I laughed. It's such a daily occurrence for me that most of the time we just all shrug it off or put it down to clumsy goodwill. But is it okay to just accept that the sighted community think they can intrude on us without asking? Are we being attacked by a particular kind of space invader? Well, here to talk about this are Scott Chesworth and Victoria Oruwari from London and John Godber from the East Midlands. Hello to you all.
Hi.
John, I'll maybe begin with you because you've had some direct experience of this being, if I'm right in saying, picked up by the handle of your rucksack.
That's right. All blind and partially sighted people, lots of examples of people, I suppose, meaning well and trying to help. Actually, personally, I found it really weird that people should think that when you're approaching somebody who can't see you, it's okay to do it without saying anything. That just seems to be just so counterintuitive. I don't understand why that happens. But, yeah, I was on standing on the railway platform in a quiet station, and I thought I was on my own until the train kind of came to a stop. And what I would normally do when I'm on my own is actually, it's all very blind, but I'd kind of walk forward, find the side of the train and feel along it until I find the door. But on this occasion, I didn't need to because as I was standing there, my rucksack was grabbed fairly violently from behind, and I was yanked along like a piece of luggage. And you have to fight yourself not to swear and steam at that, because it could have been anything.
You need to get yourself some wheels, John. Like a
it's
proper
on my back.
Yeah, well, a proper set of luggage.
The backwards kind of thing.
Yeah.
What do you say to that, John? Did you react at all? Were you able to say anything? Was it just you were caught out in the moment?
I react in all sorts of different ways when things like that happen, Scott, but it does happen so suddenly and unexpectedly normally that, you know, if I'm really geared up and in a busy place where I think it might happen, I would just smile and say, oh, thank you very much, may I take your elbow or something. I think I just kind of went along with it because he let go as we got to the door and it was okay, you know. And in the end, what I wanted to do was get on the train, and I got on the train, so you kind of grin and bear it. But
how do you feel when something like that happens to you?
Annoyed, frustrated, sometimes humiliated. It flashes through. I think, you know, you kind of... There are lots of things about being blind which actually aren't very much fun, but if you let them get on top of you, you would just struggle every single time you went out. I've come across people who don't want to go out because of the encounters they have with members of the public. Don't like being stared at, don't like people, you know, maybe if I go out with a white cane, some people say I might get, might be the victim of an attack or whatever. The trouble is, if you let that happen, you just stop going out. So
exactly.
Grinning and bearing it, but internally fuming and feeling very angry and frustrated.
Mm, okay. Yep. Scott, if I can just ask you, you've posted various incidents and experiences that you've had on Facebook. Tell us about some of yours.
I think stations and public transport tend to be like hot spots for these kind of weird encounters. I post a lot of stuff on Facebook when it happens to me, just because I don't know. I find that kind of frustration that John described before. I find that kind of writing that down and kind of trying to slot some gags in there and just sort of see the funny side of stuff tends to make me feel better than anything else about it. So I'm trying to think of an example. So I'm sitting on a train and this guy comes and he gets on and he does the whole like kind of gentle squeeze of the shoulder so that I know I'm being addressed. And he says in a very soothing voice, completely uninvited, he says, I just want you to know that there are people like me who understand how difficult every day must be for you.
Oh, dear.
I know. And it's good intentions, right? But I wasn't really in the mood. So no. I came back with, well, if you understand that, then you'll also understand why I don't really want to talk about it and put my headphones in. And, I mean, people think... It's a tricky one because it's always done with the best intentions, right? And in some cases, like travelling around London in rush hour, for example, people trying to help, however badly they're doing it, that is the last vestige of positivity that you'll ever see from humanity. So I don't want to kind of chide people too much because they mean well. Do you know what I mean? It's a tricky one.
Yeah.
It's a really tricky one.
Yeah. Victoria, you've had similar experiences, haven't you?
I've had several. I'm trying to pick up of one of them. I mean, sometimes I think almost one in 3 days when I go out in the week, because I'm in central London, I get people trying to guide me one way or the other. Either they grab my shoulder or they grab my stick. And that is, I think it's much more scary when they grab my stick.
They grab your cane. Wow.
Yeah, they grab my cane and then they pull it from the other end so that I follow like a bit. I mean, I shouldn't laugh because if that's my way of dealing with it. If I don't laugh, then the next thing would be to get angry or cry. And I just think it's much better to laugh. But
one of these days, someone's going to do that to one of us and someone's going to end up getting, like, garrotted.
Yeah, but...
Because it happens so fast.
It's scary because, you see, they pull the stick thinking... Pull the cane because they think they're helping you.
Yeah.
But they're taking away your mobility aid. So I often tell them, can you please not do that?
Yeah,
or can you please not do that? Or when I'm getting off the bus, when you get to that point where you're stepping out of the bus, someone grabs the end of your cane. So how do you know how low the step is? So one person in front is grabbing your stick, your cane, and then somebody else from behind is grabbing your shoulder. And then the third person is grabbing your other free arm. And I'm like, great. So I am expected to get off this bus without any control over my descent. You know, and then I think the final experience I actually had was one time I was walking down the road and someone came up to me and said, oh, I would like to lay my hands on you, you know, and pray for your healing. And I think that day I was feeling quite patient. So I let him do what he wanted to do. And then I said, okay, if you don't mind, I would like to pray for you too. He was like, oh, no, I'm fine. I said, no, seriously, because I really think you do need my prayers. So I put my hand on his forehead too.
You and prayed I said, for him.
I do hope and pray that God opens your eyes to see beyond your nose.
Oh, if you can't beat him, join him. That's beautiful.
You know, so, and when it does happen, like, there's some days that I actually, if I feel that I'm not feeling, you know, emotionally strong enough to deal with all these adverse, you know, contacts, that unwanted contact, as I would call it, I don't leave my house, but I leave my house knowing that, okay, I will be, you know, I'm expecting to be generally assaulted by someone, because it almost certainly does happen every day. And on a bad day, it can make you, you know, leave you feeling degraded.
This is the interesting thing about all of this, because, you know, you've all talked there about unwanted touch, unwanted contact, however you want to put it. But, you know, John, you talked there about the issue of being attacked on the street. How do you know the difference between someone helping you and attacking you when, you know, in your case, they just grab you by the rucksack?
Well, that's the trouble. You don't know. You've got no idea. And because now I'm totally blind, I can't even tell sometimes whether there's anybody anywhere near me. So these offers of help or whatever they are come literally out of nowhere. And all I can say so far, nobody's grabbed my wallet or anything else. It's just been people trying to help, sometimes clumsily.
Do we think that we are more likely to be helped when we are being grabbed, as opposed to being assaulted or attacked or mugged or whatever, because we get so many experiences like that?
No, I think we're more likely to be. I mean, I don't genuinely believe that the average member of the public wants to hurt me. But what I get angry about is the fact that every adult in the United Kingdom has a right to personal space, and mine isn't being respected. And I feel that, you know, I was actually looking at the legal definition of personal space online yesterday, because I always feel that something, a right of mine, is being violated when someone grabs me without talking to me first. And, you know, they did say something about the personal space is a space, a region of space surrounding you that you regard as your own. And I think every human being has a right to that. And in this case, I actually think children, there are a lot more laws in society to protect children from, because if you see a 4-year-old walking on the road on its own, even if you know that 4-year-old is actually much more vulnerable than the average blind person, that 4-year-old would not be approached and touched because of all the laws protecting them. Why aren't there similar laws to protect me?
I think a good way of illustrating the point is like, I understand why people do the whole grabby thing sometimes if it's, in their mind, an urgent situation. So I see it a lot. If I'm walking towards a set of stairs or escalators, that seems to be like a trigger for people. And they're like, oh my God, that can't happen. And I mean, I can cope fine, but they don't know that. But in their mind, I suppose that's an urgent kind of grab him, stop him, help him, like that kind of situation. But if you compare that to, say, for example, someone offering you a seat on public transport, if a lot of the time people will offer me a seat and they'll say, oh, would you like to sit down? And I'll be like, no, I'm all right. Cheers. Actually, standing up's keeping me awake. And you know, if that was a pregnant woman that they were offering it to, or an old man or whatever, like, that would be the end of that. Do you know what I mean? But I find with blind people, a lot of the time, it's almost like, no, I insist. And then, like, before you know it, they're like manhandling you into this seat by the shoulders. It's like a non-optional good deed, and it's I just think that, like, disabled people are the only people that happens to, because everybody else, when you politely turn away help, well, that's it. You've politely turned away the help, but for some reason, for us, it's a bit kind of non-optional.
Okay, what about the other side of this, though? I mean, let's take Fiona Dunn's example we had at the top of the programme there. You know, in that example, she is offered assistance from someone, or is given assistance, perhaps, is the best way to put it. When she refuses that help, she's told to get lost in not very nice terms. John, how do we get round this? Because does that mean that that guy will never help another blind person again?
It could do, because people, you know, it's very frustrating that, you know, even now in 2016, you find that blind people are usually regarded under a whole set of different rules of engagement from everybody else. I mean, you wouldn't normally just kind of go to somebody and manipulate them, apart from in an emergency. You wouldn't normally, exactly. You wouldn't pick up somebody else's luggage on the train and take it off without first saying, can I help you with your bag? You just wouldn't, that wouldn't happen, but it does happen to blind people. We get grabbed. Why it is that we get treated differently, I really just don't know. But there is still that tendency to get people saying, I met a blind person and he was rude to me, so I'm never going to... And I want to say, well, what if I said to you, I met somebody from wherever you're from, Exeter, and they were rude to me, so I'm never going to help anybody else from Exeter ever again. That's complete nonsense.
We'd laugh at that, wouldn't we?
And I think one of the problems is there just aren't enough of us around, visibly on the street, for it to become commonplace for lots of sighted people. Very rarely encounter blind people, and they worry a bit about whether they're doing it right or not.
Okay, so
about that worry, do you mind if I say something? Because there was something on Facebook recently about a lady who just joined a blind pen pals group, and to emphasize the level of that worry, this lady joined blind pen pals because she wants to know a lot about blind people. It's a group that brings a lot of blind people from all over the world together. And she said, oh, there's this blind man in my community who goes to work every day, and I walk quietly behind him because I always worry that I see him struggling with his cane and that would hurt him. And, you know, I feel
That's
sorry for him. So I stand behind him and follow him, and he doesn't know that, but just to see in case he falls so I can grab him.
Man,
and,
that's
you know,
creepy.
Lots of blind people had really varied reactions to that lady's post.
I can imagine. But the question I wonder is, you know, we've got the microphone here. Let's use it wisely. We can all talk about the negatives of this, but actually, what are the solutions? What can we do? What can we as people who are out there and that are visible in the streets do to educate people on this?
I think it's possible to save most people with a conversation. So, you know, there have been a lot of times where it starts off with, it will literally sometimes open with, man, it's amazing how you get around. It's like Daredevil. And you just kind of explain how it works. And most people, I would say probably like 80% of the time, in my experience, people are kind of savable, as I call it. And you can kind of get them past that whole, this is amazing, this is brave. Do you know what I mean? You can get them past that stuff.
Not from my point of view, though. A lot of people that I have tried to speak to still say at the end, well, I couldn't do it if it was me. You know, I still think you're very brave.
Yeah, no, you have
to go
deeper.
From my point of view, I think the television has a lot to do to help, because there are lots of programs where they have documentaries and things like that, and more people tend to believe what they see on television than what they see. They see things on the street, and it has an impression on one person, but the television has would have an impression on a huge mass of people.
See, my experience is the direct opposite to that, because I've done some stuff on TV, and I found that really hard, primarily because the reaction was just, oh, you're amazing, and I couldn't, for some reason, I couldn't talk people past it, because they'd seen it on telly and decided. So
how do we?
Because
this conversation you're talking about, I have had it with a lot of people,
yeah.
And they still walk away telling me, "Well, you know, it's as if you're creating a story that is still
practical,
too fantastic to be believed."
But take practical examples. Obviously, not every conversation is this long. But if you can, take a practical example with them, like something that they do in their life every day, and make them talk through how they would do it, and literally it usually takes like one example and they kind of go, oh yeah. And it obviously there's a lot to this, so you know, it's just one aspect that you've changed their
really
point of view
true
of.
And I think wherever you can steel yourself or whatever to have the conversation, then do, because it is awareness and making people kind of think a bit differently. It's that's what we can do. The trouble is sometimes you're in that position where the person just grabs you and then you know, disappears, and there's
yeah,
no time
all over before,
for a conversation.
Before
it's all over
anything.
In the twinkling of an eye. But if you can have the conversation, and you know, then that's the best thing to do.
Yeah.
I still think. I mean, I know that people say that the television doesn't work, but I still think that a series of programs that can focus on educating the public about blindness and blind people in general would reduce the fear. I mean, I do my best as an individual when I meet people to engage them in conversation. When I'm out in the street, I used to write a blog post about my experiences as a blind person, and I tweeted them and all of that, you know. But I still think that there isn't enough representation of blind people, even in soaps and things that the general public relate to. And if there can just be a little bit more information, as opposed to just short glimpses of the lives of blind people when they're doing amazing things, then people will just gradually but surely get educated about the way we live.
Lots of food for thought there. Guys, I appreciate you coming on. John Godber, Scott Chesworth and Victoria Oruwari. Thank you. So perhaps a few suggestions about how to respond there. Thanks, everyone, for that. If you would like to comment on this story and tell us your experiences, please do get in touch. Send us an email to theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, you can find us at RNIB Radio. Use the hashtag, though. That is TheWeeklyConnect. Now, we'll be hearing more about this later in the programme. Fee Dunn shared her story with us, and some of you might find it shocking.
Oh, my God. Can you just let go of me, please?
Okay. Am I only helping you?
No, you're not.
No, f*** that.
Wow.
Hear more about that encounter coming up here on The Weekly Connect very soon. But let's lighten the mood a little bit with our Where in the World this week. We haven't done this for a while. Let's skip back to Where in the World Are We? This one was given to us by one of the Weekly Connect producers who suggested that this would be an excellent idea for Where in the World. I'll let you decide. Where do you think we are this week? Okay. Well, if you can work out from that, then you are well travelled. That's all I can say. If you think you know where in the world we are, then hold on to that thought. We'll tell you later in the programme if you're right. This is The Weekly Connect.
Join RNIB Connect and become part of a wider and stronger community led by blind and partially sighted people. Membership is free, and it's the best way to keep in touch with things that are of interest and help to you. You'll receive Connect Magazine, our monthly membership publication, in your chosen format, as well as having the chance to be amongst thousands of like-minded blind and partially sighted people, friends, families and supporters. You'll also be able to take part in and organise social activities in your area, campaign for change and improve the lives of people with little or no sight, and get help from a dedicated RNIB Connect support team. It couldn't be easier to join RNIB Connect. Simply complete the online form at rnib.org.uk or join over the phone by calling 0303 1234 555.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
It's time for our Society of the Week this week, and it's one of the longest running organisations for the visually impaired community in the Northeast.
Hello, my name's Anne and I'm 63, and I was registered blind in 2011, but I've actually had retinitis pigmentosa now for over 30 years. I was signposted to Herib when I was registered blind in 2011, and I was very sceptical at first, but I did get involved with them, and I am so pleased that I did. It's one big family, really, and it's so welcoming when you go there. All the members of staff are so welcoming. They make you feel at home.
Hello there, my name is Sandra Ackroyd. I'm the Chief Executive of HERIB, which is Hull and East Riding Institute for the Blind. HERIB have been going over 150 years now. We celebrated our 150th anniversary 2 years ago, so we're very proud of that achievement. And we've been in a number of locations within the city of Hull. People really access a number of different services here. So we have a resource centre, we have home visitors that can go out and help people in their own homes with lighting assessments, magnification and so on. A lot of our people like to come and join us to really get peer support from other people who are in similar situations. And there's a lot of social interaction. So we have day groups, we have socialised groups that have outings and so on, in a friendly sort of setting as well, or quite informal.
I've taken advantage of joining the singing group, and I do like my singing. But through this also, I've taken up temping bowling. We've done pottery. We've done archery. And I've had wonderful days out with to places that I wouldn't normally be able to go because family and friends are working. I'm at home alone. And it's just so nice to have the group there.
So as part of our socialise offering, this is really to help people who might want to access a number of different type of activities. And we've got some great things going on there. So one of the groups we have, for example, is acoustic shooting, which we've recently set up. Not quite as dangerous as it sounds for blind and partially sighted people. I was quite worried about it when we first started talking about shooting. But it is something that a lot of people get a lot out of. And last year, we actually even attended the National Championships of Acoustic Shooting for blind and partially sighted people. So again, that was something that was great to be part of.
Well, I used to go shooting years and years ago, well, when I was in my late teens, early 20s. But then, of course, when my sight got worse, I wasn't able to do it anyway because I can't see the target. So then when I started to get more and more involved with the socialised group, and I said, can I come shooting? So I said, yeah, if you want to. And of course, the first week I went, I got a straight 10, and they said, you're not coming anymore. It's really good banter, you know. I'm the only lady that goes at the moment, which is not good because they all call me Annie Oakley.
So another thing that we're really excited about here at HERIB, as some of you may know, Hull have actually been chosen to be the UK City of Culture in 2017. And we're really pleased, actually, that we're actively engaging with the City of Culture team. So we're actually going to be putting together a tactile sculpture which will have other sort of sensory stimulation, so sound and smells and so on. And we're doing this in collaboration with other regional Yorkshire societies. And that's actually going to reside in the eye hospital at Hull Royal Infirmary. So again, that's something we're very excited about.
My personal experience since becoming involved with HERIB has been very, very uplifting and fulfilling, making good friends. And we all have a purpose to make life more pleasant and more endurable. To blind and partially sighted people, HERIB, to me, is the oasis in the desert.
It really is incredible, isn't it? The work of local societies and, you know, just the way that they all manage to work together to help themselves and other blind and partially sighted people. If you want to nominate your society, get in touch and put them forward. Please do that because, you know, the work they do often maybe isn't recognised nationally. So, you know, we can do it. We can tell everybody about how wonderful your society is. Email theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk or tweet us at RNIB Radio using the hashtag #TheWeeklyConnect. Now, you can reach us from anywhere, home or abroad. And talking of which, Ron Graham from the good old US of A got in touch with our own Laura Kirker to give us his contribution for this week's World Connect. Now, Ron Graham was bulletproof in his career as a prison officer in a Texas jail, or so he thought. When he got behind the wheel of a car, the cocktail of alcohol and too much adrenaline got the better of him. Let's hear Ron's story.
I'm Ron Graham. I live in Houston, Texas. And before going blind, I worked for 13 years with the Texas prison system, starting there 3 months out of high school and made it up to the rank of captain. Had the goal of becoming a senior warden before I retired, but then fate intervened. I began in high school, you know, with the idea that drinking and driving was okay, and continued that through adulthood, throughout my career of making good choices at work. As long as nothing bad happened, I continued that. And In 1993, I flipped a car after consuming a good bit of alcohol, and that led to a head injury that severed both optic nerves, leaving me totally blind. Immediately after this happened was probably one of the scariest moments of my life, because I woke up in the hospital and I couldn't see. I couldn't speak either. I had a tracheostomy, so I couldn't ask anyone what's going on, turn on the light. So it was scary, confusing. My arms were strapped down. They told me that I was blind, and I said, no, my eyes haven't woken up yet. I was in a coma for 2 months. And it took finally a second opinion that sort of hit me over the head to say, you've got to accept this, if not forever, at least for today. I had moved back home with my parents. It was like I was a child again under their rules. And as much as they loved me and they tried to give me autonomy, I still felt stifled. I knew I needed the confidence, the competence to go out and take my life back. Within 6 months after I moved back home, I had been to blind rehab. I moved out with a friend in a rental house. And a year later, I bought my first house of my life. You know, something I hadn't done when I was sighted. I went out and bought my first home. Career in criminal justice is not very safe when you can see with 20/20 vision, much less when you think about doing it totally blind. So what I soon learned was I had 13 great years of work experience. In Texas, if you go to a state college or university, your tuition is waived here. That's one of the perks of being a blind Texan. I thought, you know, you've got the work experience, you need to get your education. And I thought about the psychology classes I loved. So I went on and pursued my bachelor's in behavior psychology, and following that, a master's degree in clinical psychology. People told me early on, well, if you don't know Braille, you're illiterate. Well, no, I'm not illiterate. I'm just illiterate in that medium. But I can sit here and write and read just as well as anybody else in my medium. It may not be Braille, but I will hold my own with any academics. I had a type and speak, which was basically a talking word processor. Finding your resources, converting them into a text document, and loading those into the type and speak. I can read any document. I had a scanner that would do OCR and convert the document into a readable text document. A lot of times it was having a reader read to me and I was typing while they were reading, taking notes. Or I would get the books on tape from, it used to be Recordings for the Blind, and now it's Learning Ally. Great resource for getting college textbooks. One of the biggest things that I had coming into the blindness was a visual memory. I explained to my professors, if you can read aloud the problems you're writing on the board, I can sit down and work this problem. And it was a matter of adding the visual memory as one of my resources in my toolbox. I know how much the technology enhanced my abilities, and I've talked to some friends who had their college degrees from the 70s and 80s, and I said, how did you do that? For them, a cassette player was high tech. It was a lot of time with readers, a lot of time studying their Braille. And I think in the days before today's technology, that pursuing college without any Braille skills would be a monumental task. I don't know that you could do that then. But the advent of technology, I've often said to people, no one would ever ask to be blind. But if you ever have to be, today's the best day ever due to the technology that exists. My biggest mission, I feel, is to be there and share the resources and information with others so it's not as frustrating to them. That's something that struck me very personally, and I don't want it to be as rough on others as it was on me. So I think the biggest thing to know is that there is life after vision loss.
Such an interesting series of thoughts there from Ron, isn't it? And, you know, for someone who has come through what he has, to say there's life after vision loss, well, there must really be, if that's what he suggests after going through all of that. Ron's story, very interesting, and thank you, Ron, for sharing here on The Weekly Connect. This is The Weekly Connect. Thank you for getting in touch with us as you do. I know lots of you getting in touch on Twitter and email. Keep those emails coming in. Even if you've never sent us an email before, maybe this is the week to do it. You can also, just a quick reminder on this, you can also send us a recording from your iPhone. If you have have an iPhone, then why not get in touch with us? Send us a recording of your thoughts on any topic at all, anything at all that you think we should be talking about here. It could be transport, it could be attitudes around sight loss, it could be one of our topics we've discussed in the past few weeks around shared spaces or schemes. Could be even around the US election. Maybe you're a US voter and you've voted in the upcoming election or are hoping to. Well, do get in touch with us. We'd love to hear your thoughts. theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk is where you can send all your audio or your thoughts to. And on Twitter, we are at RNIB Radio. Use the hashtag there, TheWeeklyConnect. Now, how do you think you would cope if you found out that your son or daughter, your newborn son or daughter, had sight issues? Well, later we hear from Olivia's dad and find out how their family coped with the unexpected.
It was only after the midwife left the room that Olivia kind of opened her eyes a little and I noticed that they were opaque.
More on that. And we are also going to be giving you the answer to our "Where in the world are we this week?" question. This is the clue. Can you work out from this? I bet you thought the singing would help. Well, if it didn't, then don't worry, I'll give you the answer later. But if you think you know, then hold on and see if you're a smarty pants. This is The Weekly Connect.
After years of campaigning, it's here. Live in England? Thanks to NHS England's Accessible Information Standard, all information you receive from health and adult social care providers now has to be available in a format you can read. This means that all of those appointment letters, leaflets, letters about treatment and conditions, as well as information to do with your medication and prescriptions, now have to be available in your preferred format. RNIB is encouraging everyone to let their GP know of their preferred format, whether large print, audio, braille, or email, so that it's flagged on people's records and shared with other departments and specialists to ensure you get information in your format. For more information and to find out how you can let your GP know which format you'd prefer to hear from them in, visit rnib.org.uk/needittoreadit or call the campaigns team on 0207 391 2123.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, earlier we spoke to Scott, Victoria and John about their experiences with the space invaders, as we're calling, inappropriate touching, grabbing you when you're walking along the street if you use a white cane or you have a guide dog. Well, let's hear from Fee Dunn, who was left altogether shaken after a brief encounter.
Oh, my God. Can you just let go of me, please?
Okay. Am I only helping you?
No, you're not.
No, f*** that.
Wow. That was horrible. Wow, that was really horrible. Wow, that I'm quite shocked. No one's ever actually sworn at me like that before. That's... wow. That's horrible. Yeah. Anyway. He just grabbed me, though, and I didn't want to be grabbed. I was fine. I was just walking along. There wasn't anything to walk round or anything. He was just interfering and grabbing hold of me. And I thought I was quite polite, actually. Hello. I thought I would do a follow-up on yesterday's horrible thing to just show maybe more to other people, actually, sighted people, the crap that you sometimes have to put up with if you're blind, because what often happens is that people think that if you're blind, it's quite okay for them to grab hold of you without asking. And it isn't okay. It never was. It's never okay for someone to grab anyone without asking, apart from if it's your child or elderly relative or somebody similarly vulnerable who's, or anyone who's about to go in a road or something and hurt themselves badly. But other than that, it isn't okay. I'm just walking up to that same road and I thought I'd share the experience with you, because I thought I was okay, but now that I've got to walk to this same road, I'm thinking, what if this guy's here again? Because I think I've come across him before. And hopefully, now that he's told me to F off, maybe he'll leave me alone. But, I mean, it's one thing taking someone's arm and getting it wrong, and then saying, oh, I'm sorry. But it's quite another telling someone to F off in such a vicious way. He sounded so angry. That's what shocked me, actually. Not the rest. The grabbing thing happens to me quite regularly, and I ask people to let go. But his anger, his utter outrage and viciousness, that was really quite something. So now I'm waiting to cross the road in a slightly different place. So I'm going to catch a bus. And, this. And now, thank you. The other side, yes. Now that bloke just told me when it was clear. He was brilliant. I do understand that some people do the grabbing thing instinctively. I don't know why. But when you're moving your arm in a way that says, I want you to let go of my arm now, and they still hang on to your arm, that's when it troubles me quite a lot, actually. Well, there you are. I've been on the other side of the road where I was yesterday. Nothing bad happened. And I'm sure next time it'll be even easier. That incident happened just over a year ago now. And while it shook me up, I want to stress that it is an isolated incident. I haven't had a repeat of it. Most of the time, if I move away, they'll say sorry and let go. But the man wouldn't let go of my arm and swore at me. And it shook my confidence. But now, I don't even think about it for the most part. I really think there needs to be some public education, because a lot of people who grab the arm of a blind person, they imagine what they would feel like if they were blind. They think they would be helpless. They've got to take your arm, I don't know, maybe to save you from yourself. And one of the most important aspects of this is that it's frightening for anyone to be grabbed, but it is actually even more frightening when you can't see the grab coming. The person taking your arm could be about to try and abduct you or mug you or something. You just don't know. You know, if you don't speak to somebody and you just grab them, they're going to find that really frightening.
Well, many thanks to Fee for revisiting that blog piece for us and for her thoughts on it 1 year on. Clearly, still something that is front and centre of Fee's mind. Have you had a similar experience? How do you handle all of this? And how have those helpful hands responded? And, you know, are there good experiences as well? I mean, it can't all be bad. It can't all be like that, surely. There must be good examples out there where people have helped and actually it was really needed. Do get in touch. Get in touch on email or on Twitter. Those details again for you, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB using the hashtag #TheWeeklyConnect. And speaking of tweets, Brian Giles got in touch to say, good on you, Fiona, for sharing. Glad someone else gets how not helpful people are sometimes. share your views on Twitter and on email to the Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Now, each week on the Weekly Connect, we hear from guide dog owners across the UK. We call it Pause for Thought. Yes, we know what we did there. Well, this week we hear from Martin and his guide dog, Wheeler.
After many years of saying I would never have a dog, I always believed I'd got too much residual sight. About 3 years ago, I got knocked down by a cyclist in Warwick. He was riding the wrong way up a one-way street, so obviously I hadn't looked for him. And that sort of knocked my confidence. And also at the time, we had a puppy in training in the office. I worked for Warwickshire County Council. And part of what they did was they brought some dogs into Warwickshire County Council to give people the experience of being led by a dog. But as a visually impaired person, I couldn't pass up that opportunity. And so after having a go and feeling what it's like to be led by a dog, it really sort of was a bit of a no-brainer that I see about applying for one. And I was very, very lucky because I got accepted and I got Wheeler very quickly. He's a beautiful dog. I'm very lucky to have him. We bonded very quickly. He's very affectionate and he does a good job. In September last year, when I was in Derby with some friends, we're having a bit of a school reunion, and myself and three other people, one of whom is also a guide dog user, we were refused service in a restaurant. The proprietor was very rude. He just kept saying, no dogs, and then he asked us to leave because he had customers waiting to serve. I felt very angry and hurt and discriminated against. I mean, I know the law. I've been an equality officer. I know what the Act says, and I know my rights. And, I felt hurt and angry. We reported them to the Equality Commission, and then I put it on the Derby Telegraph Facebook page because I thought that people needed to know, and I named and shamed the restaurant, obviously. The post on the Derby Telegraph website was shared several hundred times. I had lots and lots of positive comments, people saying that it was disgusting, and the number of people who said they weren't going to use that restaurant again was very high. The BBC got involved, the film crew came down to Warwick, where I live, and filmed Wheeler and I in a local cafe. And but unfortunately, when the BBC approached the restaurant, he lied and said that the restaurant had been full, and that's why we were turned away. Nothing came of it other than I think he lost quite a lot of custom. Just to counterpoint that, an Indian restaurant round the corner from me the first time I went in, he said no dogs. I explained he was a guide dog, and now he makes us very welcome.
Well, what a relief to hear they were welcomed elsewhere, eh? Let's hope the other chap will see the error of his ways. Perhaps a stern letter from the Equalities Department is in the post. Who knows? It's not every business owner who will turn away a guide dog and their owner, but it does happen. Guide Dogs tweeted last week about the story of a family with their children left in tears after an abusive driver refused to take them. He was eventually talked around, but what a way for a family to be treated after a birthday meal. Absolutely shocking. Well, families take most of the challenges they are thrown by sight loss in their stride, and Olivia's dad is no exception to this. RNIB Connect magazine featured this story back in June, and as it comes up to her birthday this month, let's take the time to visit them again.
Olivia's now 2.5. She was born with corneal sclerosis, so she was essentially fully blind when she was born. She was seen by one of the ophthalmologists in Edinburgh, Brian Fleck, the first day of her life, and was referred down to Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children. And she underwent transplantation of her left cornea aged 2 months and then her right cornea aged 4 months, and subsequently has had a further 18 operations. Essentially, she had corneal sclerosis, so her eyes were completely opaque when she was born. The cause of this, we don't know. It's not something that runs in the family, and it wasn't anticipated before she was born. So essentially what they've done is chopped that out and replaced it with a cornea of a donor. But she's had a number of further procedures to try and fine-tune things, create new pupils, and she's had a number of rejection episodes because obviously these are not her own corneas, so she requires a number of powerful drugs to try and prevent her rejecting her corneas. But, you know, it's a lot of effort. We have, like many parents, very busy working lives, but now have to get up an extra hour earlier just to give her all her drugs in the morning and an hour at night, and she's got several drugs during the day to get as well. So, but despite that, you know, she's a fantastic little kid who is, as I say, very much a character. When Olivia was born, she actually passed her midwife check, and it wasn't recognised immediately that she was blind. But she had vernix in her eyes, and it was only after the midwife left the room that Olivia kind of opened her eyes a little, and I noticed that they were opaque, and my wife also noticed as well, and it's just that horror moment of, oh my Lord, what's going to happen? And your whole life just rushes ahead of you. You just think it's just completely unexpected. Very difficult to explain, actually. And Olivia was born at the end of November, which is, of course, getting into the festive period, and you had ideas of what your child's first Christmas was going to be like, and it was certainly not the first Christmas we were anticipating. But I think the funny thing is Christmas time for us was maybe hopeful because she wasn't transplanted until the 26th of January, but we noticed that she reacted very well to Christmas lights and lights that changed in colour. And so we went out and bought what was essentially Blackpool illuminations for the house. So we probably overdid things, but it certainly gave us something to do and gave us hope, I suppose, that she did react to these things. And, I mean, we're very much aware that visual development's most important in the first few months of life, and we were doing everything we could to try and encourage that. As parents, we were left alone in terms of the emotions, the psychological effects of this. A support network was not there. And as I say, many of the things that we did to try and encourage visual development in those early stages were done off our own back, whether they were right or wrong, it's what we thought was right. Things are different now. We have a visual support teacher, who Lynn Limer, who's lovely, and you know she's a lovely person to talk to, a very calming influence, and can allay some of our fears. But of course, nobody can predict what happens in the future. Support mechanisms are difficult. We've not had any form of counselling offered to us. In fact, one of the children that was transplanted at the same time as Olivia uses us as a support mechanism. They phone us for advice quite a bit of the time, and it would be nice if obviously that was a two-way street, but it's difficult. As a parent, you're willing to do anything to give your child this chance of sight, but it's very difficult to look at the long term and know where we're going from here. You don't know how she's going to be in 2 years' time, 5 years' time, or even when she's a fully grown adult and having children of her own or grandchildren of her own. But what we know is that now she functions exceedingly well as a child. She's very articulate. She is independent around the house. Haven't got her into household chores yet, but we're working on it. You know, if she's blind at the end of this, the bottom line is she knows what her mother looks like, she knows what her father looks like, and she knows what flowers look like. And that's the most important thing.
Interesting to hear from Olivia's dad there. Thank you for sharing your story and telling us what it's like to be the parent of a blind child. You know, this show is not just for blind and partially sighted people. If you are someone who has a blind child and maybe you want to tell us how wonderful they are, as I'm sure you will, then you can get in touch. theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Equally, if you know someone who is blind or partially sighted, maybe a good friend, and you want to share their story or your story about your friendship with them and what you've learned about sight loss, then do get in touch. No one is left out here on The Weekly Connect. That is it for our show this week. Just one more thing to do before we go, one more piece of business, and that is our Where in the World this week. Yes, where on earth were we? Well, if you couldn't figure it out from this clue, then, well, really there's no hope, frankly. ¶¶ So that sound is actually of the Indonesian gamelan orchestra. So we were in Indonesia this week. We do get around in the world, don't we? We really do. Our producer actually recorded that, and yeah, that was her idea this week, so you can blame her. That is it for the Weekly Connect this week. Thank you to everybody who got in touch with us over the past week, and also those of you who've been getting in touch on Twitter as well, reacting to our stories. Please do keep doing that. This is your programme. It is the place where you can talk about the issues that matter to you. So if you have a view on anything you've heard in this programme or in previous ones, do get in touch. Email theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or you can get in touch on Twitter @RNIBRadio using the hashtag #TheWeeklyConnect. Next week we're discussing blind versus partially sighted. What are the differences of being blind as opposed to being partially sighted? We're not putting them side by side for comparison, except in the sense that the experiences of blind people are often very different to those of partially sighted people. It's often thought in the wider world that all of our experiences, whether you're blind or partially sighted, are the same. But what are the challenges? Are they different? Well, we're putting that to you on next week's programme. Get in touch. Your voice could be on air with us next week. Keep in touch by email, theweeklyconnects@rnib.org.uk, or as I say, get in touch via Twitter @RNIB Radio. Until next time, thanks for listening.